ASVP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
One of the reasons we can't tell what's going on and what power they have is because they haven't really made what they're doing public at all.
Who is working in the Department of Government Efficiency and what exactly are they doing?
For Friday, February 7th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour I speak with the pastor of a church that now owns the trademark for the Proud Boys.
The far-right extremist group vandalized the church's sign back in 2020.
Our victory magnifies the fact that we need not shrink in this moment politically.
Also, the threat of new tariffs on European goods is causing Americans to stockpile Italian wine.
They don't take our cars, they don't take our farm products, they take almost nothing. And we take everything from them.
And the story of the first woman to write an autobiography in English.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump reaffirmed today he supports SpaceX CEO Elon Musk's remaking of the federal government via what the administration is calling DOGE. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben has more.
Speaking at a press conference, Trump was unclear about his own role in DOGE's actions, but seemed to say he had given Musk wide rein.
I think everything's fertile. You know, we're a government. We have to be open. And as an open government, I don't know, I guess you could say maybe some high intelligence or something. And I'll do that myself if I have to.
He added several times that he wants DOGE to target the Education Department and the military for cuts. Trump did say he doesn't plan on having Musk make changes to Social Security or Medicare, but added that the administration would be looking for fraud in those programs. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, the White House.
The Trump administration is now delaying the end of a loophole in import tax that's helped some companies import cheap goods from China. The president just closed the loophole as part of his new tariffs on Chinese imports, but is now pausing that plan while customs inspectors look at the big change. NPR's Alina Selyukh has more.
For almost a century, U.S. law has carved out an exemption for small packages to not have to pay import duties. That's allowed packages worth under $800 to arrive in the U.S. duty-free. While most retailers ship in bulk, ultra-cheap retailers like Shein and Temu ship individual packages directly from China to shoppers in the U.S. and use the exemption to avoid paying tariffs. And that saved them millions of dollars, and their popularity has exploded. President Biden and bipartisan lawmakers in Congress have pushed to close the loophole, and Trump did. But this created chaos for U.S. customs and shipping companies, and Trump has now delayed the plan, unclear for how long. Alina Selyukh, NPR News, Washington.
Springfield, Ohio is suing a neo-Nazi group for its alleged role in harassing, intimidating, and inciting violence against the city and its residents. As NPR's Odette Youssef reports, Springfield was the center of a national firestorm over immigration in the months before the presidential election.
The civil lawsuit against the neo-Nazi group Blood Tribe was brought by Springfield's mayor, three city commissioners, and four residents who are public in their support of Haitian immigrants. It claims the group interfered with plaintiffs' federal civil rights, that it created a public nuisance, and that it incited violence. The suit alleges, among other things, that the neo-Nazis instigated dozens of bomb threats and that they instructed strangers to enter some plaintiffs' homes at night without knocking to demand drugs and sex. None of the plaintiffs themselves are Haitian residents of Springfield. Instead, the complaint paints a picture of a city terrorized by a campaign of hate. The Blood Tribe has not publicly posted a response. Odette Youssef, NPR News.
Stocks lost ground at week's end on Wall Street. The Dow fell 444 points. The Nasdaq dropped 268 points today. You're listening to NPR. The search has ended for a missing plane that vanished just south of the Arctic Circle. The plane with 10 people aboard, including the pilot, disappeared yesterday afternoon near the Norton Sound area while heading to Nome, Alaska. Authorities say the wreckage of the small plane has been located on sea ice, and all those on board are presumed dead. It's not clear what caused the plane to go down. Daniel Barenboim, the renowned conductor and pianist, announced this week he has Parkinson's disease. He had cut back on his engagement in recent years due to health issues, but plans to continue conducting. Jeff London reports.
The Argentine-born Jewish conductor and former piano prodigy resigned from his post at the Berlin State Opera in 2023, but is still committed to performing with the ensemble he co-founded with the late Palestinian-American scholar Edward Said in 1999. the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. Barenboim said the orchestra, featuring Arab and Israeli musicians, and its school are his most important responsibility. The 82-year-old continues to teach at the musical academy he established in Berlin and plans to conduct the orchestra on tour in August, health permitting. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
It appears the flu season in the U.S. is in full swing. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimating so far this year there have been 13,000 flu deaths, including at least 57 children. Some schools have been forced to shut down entirely due to flu outbreaks. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics with I'm Still Here, a film by Walter Salles starring Fernanda Torres. A woman is forced to reinvent herself after her family suffers an injustice by the Brazilian government. Now playing only in theaters.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Elon Musk continues to send shockwaves through the federal government. His cost-cutting team, the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, has been tearing through the government since Inauguration Day. But now, DOGE has been hit with multiple lawsuits, and a member of the team even stepped down after a series of racist social media posts surfaced. What do we actually know about this newly created entity that has so much power? What are they doing and who is working there? Well, for help understanding some of this, we're joined now by NPR's Shannon Bond, who has been following all things DOGE. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so just lay out what we know so far about what DOGE is doing.
Yeah, so our reporting shows this effort appears to be focusing on technology and personnel at federal agencies. So staffers connected to DOGE are gaining access to sensitive systems and information on government payments and about employees. And Elon Musk, who's leading the effort, has been cheering on their work on his platform X. He's taken credit for efforts to dismantle the U.S. Agency for International Development, which has funded everything from relief efforts in Ukraine to secret schools for girls in Afghanistan. Musk has also said that DOGE is shutting down what he calls, quote, illegal payments from the Department of Health and Human Services to nonprofit groups. But look, even as he's talking about all this stuff, there are still a lot of questions about the scope of what DOGE is doing and whether they actually have the authority to do it. Deborah Perlstein is a constitutional scholar at Princeton University.
One of the reasons we can't tell what's going on and what power they have is because they haven't really made what they're doing public at all.
And that also includes who it is who's doing this work.
Exactly. So what do we know about the people working for DOGE? Like, who are they?
Right. So there is a DOGE team in the White House that Musk is leading, but a lot of this stuff is actually happening in the agencies. There are staffers connected to DOGE fanning out across the federal government. So, for example, we have a number of Musk-connected figures who've been named to senior roles. That includes Tom Krause. He's a tech CEO who just today was put in charge of the Treasury Department system that processes trillions of dollars in payments every year. Now, what's notable here, Elsa, is that this week, in a legal challenge around this arrangement, the government said that Krause has read-only access to this payment system. Hmm. But then we have Musk posting publicly about shutting off payments. And so now his ally is running that system. There are other folks who've worked at Musk companies, including Tesla and XAI, who are in senior positions at the Office of Personnel Management and the General Services Administration. And of course, there's also this group of young male software engineers, right, that have gotten a lot of attention.
Oh, yeah, including the staffer who resigned just yesterday, right? Like, what was his story?
Well, his name is Marco Alez. He's a 25-year-old Rutgers University graduate who previously worked at Musk's SpaceX and at X. He was a temporary appointee at Treasury who was granted access to this payment system alongside Krause. Now, on Thursday, the Wall Street Journal identified racist posts from a social media account linked to him. Those posts have been deleted, but NPR did independently confirm them. And Ellis has now resigned, although Musk and Vice President J.D. Vance are saying he should get his job back. But all of this raises questions about just how thoroughly vetted some of these staffers are. Mm-hmm. And then there are other relatively junior engineers' names that are popping up at just at multiple agencies, creating a lot of confusion for workers and, frankly, alarm.
Well, I understand that legal challenges to DOGE are coming really quickly now. How might that affect the overall work of this team, you think?
Yeah, also, I mean, the first lawsuit about DOGE was filed just minutes after President Trump was sworn in. This week, we've had unions representing government workers suing Treasury over concerns about the DOGE staffers accessing that payment system I talk about. A judge temporarily limited access to people inside Treasury, so not Musk and his team at the White House. On Friday, the University of California student government sued to stop DOGE from gaining access to data on student loan borrowers. These lawsuits could constrain the scope of DOGE's work, but, you know, they move slowly in the legal system. Meanwhile, government workers we're speaking to say DOGE is very quickly moving ahead with this work.
That is NPR's Shannon Bond. Thank you so much, Shannon.
Thanks, Elsa.
President Trump kicked off his second term with a dramatic crackdown on immigration, ramping up arrests, terminating temporary legal protections, and transporting migrants from the U.S. mainland to Guantanamo Bay. Immigrant advocates call those moves cruel and unnecessary, but many of Trump's supporters are applauding these early steps, as NPR's Joel Rose reports.
Dozens of demonstrators gathered recently in a park across the street from the White House. From a distance, they looked like protesters. But up close, you could hear them chanting, "Freedom for Cuba." These were Cuban Americans who had come to show support for the president and push him to be even tougher on Cuba's communist government. Several of the demonstrators say they support President Trump's immigration crackdown, too.
We are thankful that Donald Trump is taking action against illegal immigration.
Alexei's Blanco Diaz was one of those demonstrators, wearing a bright red MAGA baseball hat. But there is one big way that Blanco Diaz differs from your average Trump supporter. He is himself a recent immigrant to the U.S. who fled Cuba in 2022 and is currently seeking asylum here. Blanco Diaz turned himself in after crossing the U.S.-Mexico border illegally.
I mean, I was expecting that the officials would ask me, what are you doing here? Why are you coming to this country? I came in with my papers, with all of the evidence I have of being oppressed in Cuba, but nobody asked me anything. And at that moment, I thought, this is not right.
If Blanco Diaz showed up at the border today under President Trump, he would likely be turned away. The White House has moved quickly to end several Biden-era asylum policies, closing off the CBP-1 app that allowed migrants to enter legally to ask for asylum, as well as a special humanitarian program for migrants from Cuba and other countries. Blanco Diaz says he is glad to see those Biden programs end. So is Kiel Cabrera, who grew up in Miami but still has family back in Cuba.
I think that it is a temporary necessity in order to organize the unfortunate chaos allowing 3, 4, 5 million migrants into this country.
There were a record number of migrant apprehensions at the border during the Biden administration, though the numbers dropped significantly last year. Still, some Trump supporters are eager for a tougher approach. Zvi Dechter was visiting Washington from Florida with his family.
It's an unfortunate, sad situation, but, you know, there's a lot of things going on here in America that need to be taken care of and cleaned, and I'm happy that someone is doing it.
Near the Washington Monument, Beatrice Richards was selling Trump merchandise laid out on a couple of tables on the sidewalk. Richards says she's glad to see the president keeping migrants out.
That's very good because those are bad people coming to harm people, good people here in America.
There's no evidence of a widespread migrant crime wave, although a few grisly cases have drawn a lot of attention. And the Trump administration has tried to play up that narrative with a series of high-profile arrests in major cities. And so far, a lot of his supporters are on board. Enoch Rich is a pastor from Central City, Kentucky.
My goodness, they're going 1,000 miles an hour, but it's everything that he said he wanted to do thus far.
Pastor Rich was wearing a knit Trump hat as he visited the Lincoln Memorial in Washington. While he supports the administration's crackdown, Rich says it has been alarming for congregants in his own church who immigrated from Mexico.
Those that are in the congregation are afraid.
Rich says he's tried to comfort them by saying they're not likely to be targets.
I feel like that things are not going to go down that way. I do believe, from what I've seen about Trump, that as tough as he is, that he does have a soft heart.
Immigration policy is a balance that can tip easily in either direction, Rich says. And he prays President Trump won't go too far. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
When Donald Trump was elected in November, American importers suddenly began stockpiling their favorite Italian wines in anticipation of the president's tariffs on European goods. Prosecco, as NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports, was at the very top of that list. She brings us this report from Rome.
Prosecco is the most popular Italian wine in the United States. Fun, bubbly, light. It's used in toasts at celebrations and in cocktails. And clearly, it's something Americans are not willing to give up.
Hanno reagito nel richiedere più vini dall'Italia in maniera considerevole.
U.S. imports of Prosecco skyrocketed by 41% in November after Donald Trump was elected, says Paolo Castelletti. He's the Secretary General of the Union of Italian Wines Trade Association.
Una reazione, diciamo, legata proprio alla
It's a response, he says, to the fear that Trump will impose new import tariffs on goods from the European Union. Last week, he announced tariffs against Mexico, Canada, and China. He then paused some of those tariffs, but the threat to the EU remains.
It will definitely happen with the European Union, I can tell you that, because they've really taken advantage of us.
Trump complained to reporters before boarding Air Force One recently of a trade deficit with the EU.
They don't take our cars, they don't take our farm products, they take almost nothing, and we take everything from them.
The tariffs could push up the cost of European wine for American consumers, and it could be devastating for the Italian wine industry that sends about a quarter of its exports to the US market. Italian wine growers are not the only ones concerned about the possible new tariff regime. The head of Italy's fashion chamber has appealed to the Italian government to do what it can to protect the country's second largest industry. Castelletti from the Union of Italian Wine says there are things the Italian government could do. He asks Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni to lever the privileged relationship she's cultivated with Trump to help the European Union to try to stop or limit the tariffs. Otherwise, he says, this trade war will hurt everybody. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ailsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. It sounds improbable, but after a court ruling this week, the Metropolitan African Methodist Episcopal Church here in Washington owns the Proud Boys trademark. Yes, just to be clear, you did hear that correctly. The far-right extremist group can no longer sell hats, jackets, or anything else emblazoned with their name or logo without the church's permission. And the church can also move to seize the profits from anything they do sell under that trademark. Reverend Bill Lamar IV leads the Metropolitan AME Church, and he joins us now in studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Juana.
Reverend, I'd like to just start, if I could, by asking you a little bit about how we got here. Now, for people who may not remember, back in 2020, Proud Boys members jumped a fence onto your church's property. They destroyed a Black Lives Matter banner, and a judge ordered them in 2023 to pay the church $2.8 million. They failed to do so, and so the court granted your church this trademark instead. Just start by telling us, if you know, where that idea came from.
So actually, Juan, and it is confusing, there were actually two lawsuits.
Uh-huh.
The first suit is the suit that ended with Judge Kravitz of the D.C. Superior Court granting us nearly $3 million in damages. And that is growing because interest is applied to the decision. And because they defied the order of Judge Kravitz, we appeared again with a second lawsuit. We determined that the value they had was in their trademark, which they used the license to sell merchandise to recruit for their white supremacist and fascist activities. And we went after that trademark to be made whole. They defy the court and we defy them in that we will live joyfully, we will do what we have always done without fear, even in the face of what they did to us.
There is a statement on the homepage of your church's website that I read earlier today, and part of it reads, "For the first time in our nation's history, a Black institution owns property of a white supremacist group." And that statement, as I read it, it just carries a whole lot of weight. What does it mean to you?
Well, first of all, it means that my wife is a good writer. And the second thing it means is, I think in this moment, so many people feel defeated, not only here, but geopolitically. People who believe that humans should be free and flourish and share space together. And our victory magnifies the fact that we need not shrink in this moment politically. I think that what it means is we will not always get what we want. We will not always win, but where there are victories, other victories are seated. And there is a passage of scripture where Joseph is mistreated by his brothers. And ultimately, and many people misinterpret this, and I hate the way many people interpret it, but the language is what was meant for evil, the divine repurposes for good. So I want to communicate that evil is afoot, but good is not defeated, nor is good dead, if we will continue to lift our eyes toward what's possible together.
So your church now owns the Proud Boys trademark. I do have to ask you, is there anything about this outcome that feels scary? I'll just note that members of the Proud Boys have been convicted of numerous crimes in recent years, violent crimes in some cases, in addition to vandalizing your church.
Well, I think it's clear that this is a decision that the church took, and we're clear that it was not without risk. We're clear that they are violent. We're clear that they exist to stoke violence. And we understood that Fannie Lou Hamer was taking risks in Sunflower County, Mississippi. We understand that Ida B. Wells Barnett was taking risks when she was writing about the truth of lynching. We understand that our ancestors come from a long line of those who took risks for themselves and for human flourishing. And we cannot shrink in this moment. I keep remembering the poetry of Lucille Clifton, who says, "Come celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and it has failed." This has failed and it will fail.
I'll note that President Trump has pardoned, in some cases commuted in others, sentences for members of the group, the Proud Boys, for their involvement in the January 6th riots at the U.S. Capitol just down the road here. Does that give you any pause, any concern? I understand
wanting to be bold in the face to all the inspiration you just talked about, but do you worry even a bit?
Oh, well, you have to. I mean, I think that to consider what is possible is to be realistic. But there is something in us that causes us to rise above. The kitchen table moment of Martin Luther King comes back when he is disturbed and being threatened and gets a nasty call from vitriolic racists. And he hears the voice of God saying to fight on. He hears the voice of God telling him that he was called for this purpose, and we have been called for this purpose. And it's really sad. The pardon is of a piece with the lost cause mythology. America has a way of punishing the poor, the black, the gay, the dispossessed, but letting these type of extremists, these type of violent insurrectionists, the same way that they found a way to deify the lost cause in Confederate mythology, they're trying to do that now. But we will keep speaking truth, and the light will continue to shine.
The former leader of the Proud Boys, Enrique Tarrio, was part of the group that vandalized your church. And on social media, he reacted to this judgment. He claims that he was denied due process, but he also called for your organization, for your church to be audited, to lose its nonprofit status. And it's really easy to talk about things that we see and hear on social media is just confined to that space. But in the current climate, given everything we've seen, given everything that people are experiencing right now, are you concerned that this decision could bring your ministry unwanted attention?
It is possible. And we are clear that the law is on our side. What we are doing is not outside of the law. What they did was outside of the law. And this type of gaslighting from criminals is problematic. We have to talk about it because they are trying to distract us from the work that we are to do. And much of what I'm hearing from that side, in the words of my father's late sister, who's an English teacher, Juanita Dolores Lamar, that certain kinds of ignorance deserve no response.
Do you have any sense of what your church plans to do with the money?
When we get it, we seek to repurpose it, not only to further our mission, we also want to use money, should we get it, to lift up other organizations. This will be a reverse capitalism kind of way of doing this. We're not just going to accumulate, but we're going to share with others who are doing this work around the nation. And we've been in touch with some of them. So we don't want this victory to be a moment or a one-off. We want to seed an energy and inspiration that will help us to move forward in days to come, because days to come will become more difficult.
Your church is a familiar sight for so many of us who live in and around Washington. It is historic. For many people who are perhaps hearing our conversation, this story is the first time they will have ever heard of your church. I wonder, what should they know about it? What would you like people to know and understand about your ministry?
It's a wonderful question. Our ministry is a part of the Black prophetic tradition. And the Black prophetic tradition believes that we are all siblings, and wherever there is exploitation, oppression, and extraction, our tradition has spoken into that and sought to build a space where we can live together. We have never excluded anyone. We've got the National Cathedral down the street, mm-hmm. but at a point, my grandparents were not welcome.
Right.
So we do not exclude. We love all, and we seek to build the kind of world where we can live and flourish together.
That was Reverend Bill Lamar. He's the pastor for the Metropolitan AME Church here in Washington, D.C. Reverend, thank you for coming to our studios.
Well, thank you. I'm a fan. I'm excited.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Give me a whiskey, ginger ale, and sour. And off he stands,
you baby. Greta Garbo's first lines on screen. Another golden movie moments came because of two unlikely Hollywood giants, Louis B. Mayer and Irving Thalberg.
They really believed that film could create a culture.
Their story, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
all things considered, from NPR News, I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. No matter what happens during the Super Bowl, one thing's for sure.
Emotions are gonna get intense.
Especially for Chris Jones, defensive lineman for the Kansas City Chiefs.
Never see a grown man, especially at that size, cry. But, I mean, it's an emotional game, especially to him.
I'm News.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. A federal judge has temporarily blocked the Trump administration from releasing thousands of personnel with the U.S. Agency for International Development on administrative leave. NPR's Autumn Thomas has more.
Judge Carl Nichols said he would issue a very limited temporary restraining order before midnight tonight, preventing the government from putting 2,200 federal workers on administrative leave. It would also pause the accelerated removal of agency employees who are posted overseas. Since the inauguration, the Trump administration has taken steps at dizzying speed aimed at dismantling the aid agency, including putting nearly all of the more than 10,000 employees on leave by midnight tonight. On Thursday, Secretary of State Marco Rubio approved fewer than 300 agency staff to continue working. Today, workers were seen taking down the USAID flag and sign it from the agency's headquarters in Washington, D.C. From Atlantic NPR News.
Meantime, the Justice Department has agreed not to make public for now the names of FBI agents who were involved in Capitol riot cases. This comes in response to two lawsuits filed to protect agent identities from being released to the public. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
The FBI Agents Association and groups of anonymous FBI employees filed suit after the Justice Department demanded a list of all FBI personnel involved in investigating January 6th cases. The department says names are necessary as part of an internal review. The lawsuit says agents fear the list will be used to fire people on retaliatory grounds. They are also concerned that the names could be made public, opening up agents and their families to possible threats from the 1,500 January 6th defendants that Trump pardoned. Now, according to a new court filing, the government will not make the list public, directly or indirectly, without 2 days prior notice. Well,
this is NPR. Super Bowl 59 is happening in New Orleans on Sunday, and the NFL Players Association put out a statement earlier this week supporting striking nurses at the city's University Medical Center. Drew Hawkins has more from the Gulf States newsroom.
The union representing NFL players issued a statement in solidarity with the nurses, saying that when nurses have a voice, patients are safer. And they're urging UMC to respect nurses' right to bargain, work toward a fair contract, and prioritize patient care over conflict. Haley Dupree is part of the hospital's nursing union.
The big things on this are like patient safety issues.
The nurses went on strike on Wednesday and had planned for it to last only 2 days. But hospital administrators have locked the nurses out through Super Bowl weekend, citing obligations with the staffing company who brought in contract nurses to fill in during the strike. For NPR News, I'm Drew Hawkins in New Orleans.
U.S. imports of Italian sparkling wine jumped more than 40% following President Trump's election back in November. American importers apparently stocking up on the popular sweet bubbly Prosecco ahead of the potential impact of new tariffs on the European Union that Trump has threatened. A trade group says Italy exports nearly one quarter of its wine to the U.S., leaving that sector more exposed to tariffs than any other Italian good. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments, As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. In the wake of the Los Angeles fires, President Trump blamed California officials for not sending enough water to help with firefighting efforts. Water experts debunked that claim, saying there was plenty of water already in Southern California to battle the deadly blazes. But last week, Trump directed big water releases from two dams in California's Central Valley, implying it would have prevented the fires if it had happened sooner. As KVPR's Joshua Yeager reports, that has sparked concern among water managers and local farmers who rely on that water.
According to a statement from local irrigation districts, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers flushed the water, more than 2 billion gallons, out of the dams in the Sierra Nevada foothills between last Friday and Sunday. The agency said it was to help combat wildfires in Southern California under an executive order the president signed last month. Here's Trump earlier this week in the Oval Office.
All we're doing is giving Los Angeles and the entire state of California virtually unlimited water.
The Los Angeles fires are fully contained at this point, but experts say the water would have been no use to firefighters in the city, which is nearly 200 miles south. Reservoirs there already have plenty, according to Jay Lunt, a water scientist and professor at UC Davis.
If you took the surface area of the wildfires, you could cover them in 20, 25 feet of water with all the water that's already in reservoirs in that region.
In some cases, firefighters reported hydrants going dry and a lack of water to extinguish the blazes. The issue, Lund says, was getting the water that was already there to burning neighborhoods using infrastructure that was never built to handle so much demand. So, he says the Trump administration's move this weekend to release water from Central California didn't address the problem. And, he adds, it won't help the farmers who need that water to irrigate their crops come spring.
And so it's not clear if it in fact will be useful at all.
Water gets stored behind these dams as snow melts down from the Sierra peaks. As spring turns into summer and things get hot, water managers then slowly release that water for farmers to use. The Central Valley is among the nation's most productive farmland. Joel Isaac has grown citrus here for decades.
I mean, it's our water. We need to make sure we have enough for our crops, and hopefully we have enough water this season.
A recent snow survey measured one of the driest Januaries on record for this part of the Sierra. That means less water behind the dam for crops. And Isaac anticipates he won't have a drop to spare this season.
We're overdrawing the aquifer now, which we need to replenish the water that we're taking out.
Water managers and farmers say that Trump's release of water came too early in the season to be useful for growers. As a result, they may have less water for crops when they need it. Still, Isaac and many of the Valley's growers say they stand behind Trump.
I don't think Valley growers feel that this was in any way done as an intentional, you know, attack on Valley agriculture.
Tricia Stever-Blattler runs the Tulare County Farm Bureau, which represents more than 1,000 growers in this area. The county is one of several in the region that went for Trump this election.
There's a general feeling of encouragement and excitement that these orders are taking on some very challenging issues here in this state.
For the Farm Bureau, that includes pushing for more water to go to farmers and less to be saved for an endangered fish called the Delta smelt.
In general, you know, farmers are supportive of what President Trump is trying to do in you know, relaxing some of the really draconian environmental laws in California.
But any challenge to the way water is regulated in the state has an uncertain future. California sued over similar efforts during Trump's first term. For NPR News, I'm Joshua Yeager in the Central Valley.
The there will be plenty of emotions flowing during this Sunday Super Bowl, and that is especially true of one Kansas City Chiefs player who has developed quite a reputation for wearing his heart on his sleeve. NPR's Becky Sullivan has this story.
When he's not on the football field, Kansas City defensive tackle Chris Jones likes to crack a joke.
As you guys know, I get emotional during the game. I'm an emotional guy. I wear my emotion on my sleeve.
This week, Jones has been toting around a box of Kleenex. He positions it next to his mic as he sits down to take questions.
And thankfully, I have my partner's Kleenex here with me. When there's a tear falling down, I can take a Kleenex and wipe it off and keep it going.
It's a running gag he's got going, but it comes from something real. Turn on the Super Bowl in time to watch the national anthem, and I'm sure you'll see what he's talking about.
Oh, say can you see?
During the anthem, the TV broadcast always cuts to close-ups of players and coaches, hands on their hearts, all of their faces stoic, all but one.
We're so gallantly streaming.
You might see Chris Jones taking in the moment, moved to tears. And he gets teary not just before a big game, but at the end of them, too, like when the Chiefs clinched last month's AFC Championship game against the Buffalo Bills. His teammates swarmed Jones with hugs as he sat on a bench overcome with emotion, his face buried in his hands. When he's on the field, Chris Jones is a physically imposing guy. He's 6'6", 310 pounds, a threat at any moment to break through his opponent's offensive line and disrupt what their quarterback is trying to do.
You never see a grown man, especially at that size, cry. So it's an emotional game, especially to him.
This is his teammate, Jaden Hicks. He and all the Chiefs defenders see Jones when the cameras aren't around. In the locker room, at practice, off the clock, he's a bubbly guy. Quick to smile and laugh, especially at himself, like when Jones talks about his superstitions.
I wear the same gloves, wear the same cleats. I don't change up cleats throughout the season. My gloves smell like a dead animal. especially if I get a sack in them, it's over with. I'm not changing them up.
The good thing about Chris is he's never had a bad day. He always seems to be in a great mood.
This is Chiefs defensive coordinator Steve Spagnuolo.
In the game of football, to have a guy as passionate as Chris is huge. I think other guys feed off of that because he is so talented. And they do know how much he cares. And I think that kind of infiltrates throughout the rest of the teams.
Jones is one of only five players on the Chiefs who have been around for the team's historic run of Super Bowls dating back to 2020. He's 30 years old now. He didn't always show it when he was younger, but he's always felt the emotions, he told me.
As athlete and as men, I think it's challenging at times to be that vulnerable, especially in front of the world. For me, I don't care.
The national anthem is a natural moment to reflect, he said, on his path to the NFL. He grew up in a town of 3,000 people in rural Mississippi. In high school, he used to sleep on a couch in his grandmother's house. It can be hard to believe where he is now, his ninth NFL season, and a $159 million contract signed just last year.
Whether it's year one or year nine, you know, I'm super appreciative and super humbled to be here. And you know, emotions get to flowing.
Kansas City fans have come to see his tears during the anthem as a sign of good things to come in the game. With three Super Bowl rings so far and a fourth on the line Sunday, it's a theory that's hard to dispute. Becky Sullivan, NPR News, New Orleans.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Newly installed Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth held a town hall with troops at the Pentagon today. There, he repeated something he has said a lot, that one of his main goals is to, quote, rebuild our military. This comes as the Pentagon is drawing up plans to possibly withdraw troops from Syria, and after the president's talk of the U.S. taking over Gaza prompted questions about whether the U.S. military will be involved. We've got Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman here in studio to sort through everything that happened this week. Hi there.
Hey, Wanda.
So, Tom, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth held this town hall today with troops. What stuck out to you?
Well, one thing was he indicated the increase in recruiting numbers for the Army was directly due to President Trump coming back to the White House. Let's listen.
Restoring the warrior ethos is critical. And I think we've seen that already in the recruiting numbers. I think we've seen an enthusiasm and excitement from young men and women who want to join the military actively because they are interested in being a part of the finest fighting force the world has to offer and not doing a lot of other things that serve oftentimes too often to divide or distract.
Well, there's no evidence that's true. Army officials tell me the better recruiting numbers over the past year have had to do more with changes the Army Recruiting Command made, like in a new marketing campaign, more training for recruiters. The Army also saw, get this, a 17% increase in female recruits from the previous year. Mm. One possible reason, female soldiers now have more opportunities, such as ground combat jobs, although Hegseth has questioned whether standards have been lowered to allow women in those jobs. The Army denies any lowering of standards. Hegseth has said he has promised a review.
Right. Okay, let me ask you about this, Tom. About this administration-wide anti-diversity, equity, and inclusion drive where they've sort of tagged diversity efforts as counterproductive and other things. What did Hegseth say there?
Well, Hegseth once again took on diversity at the town hall, and he said those who say diversity is our strength is what he called, quote, the single dumbest phrase in military history. And he has taken aim at DEI programs within the Pentagon and also the service academies. West Point disbanded its cadet clubs, including the Korean-American Relations Seminar, the National Society of Black Engineers, a Vietnamese-American Cadet Association, among others. I'm told the Naval Academy will soon do the same. I know professors are also combing their writings to see if they've written anything along the lines of DEI that could get them in trouble.
Mm. Let's turn now to Syria, if we can. How many U.S. troops are there, and why is this topic coming up now?
Well, the Pentagon has asked for a review and also options for the 2,000 U.S. troops in northeast Syria. They work with the Kurdish forces to go after the remnants of ISIS. The options could include one, removing them all or keeping a smaller number there. Now, Trump tried to remove all troops in 2018 and was talked out of it by his advisors. The worry is that if the U.S. leaves, ISIS could once again gain strength in both Syria and Iraq.
Last thing, Tom, President Trump surprised a lot of people when he talked about the U.S. potentially taking over Gaza. What do we know?
Well, no one was more surprised than military officials I talked with. President Trump at first said the U.S. military might get involved, then he backed off. But several retired senior officers say, listen, if the U.S. takes over Gaza, just like it did Iraq and Afghanistan, you'll likely see troops on the ground.
NPR's Tom Bowman, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. What if you could pick up the phone and call the past? Well, our next story does just that. It's the first in a new weekly segment of short-form audio documentaries. We begin with a piece from Berlin-based producer Sara Zareh Hushyoriha. This is Marjorie.
Recently, I've been thinking about what it would be like to call Marjorie Kemp. How would I talk to someone who lived over 500 years ago?
Hey, Marge.
Hello, Mrs. Kemp.
Hi, this is Sarah.
Marjorie.
Hi, Marjorie.
Marjorie. We haven't met.
Also, you're dead.
I would like to tell her about this monk. His name was Vinken de Ward. And after her death, he took the liberty to republish a few pages of her book. And he called it A Short Treatise of Contemplation. We don't know what else she wrote about in her book, but he references it, and so we know that it existed at some point. And in his Treatise of Contemplation, he describes her, Marjorie Kemp. And he describes her as a very quiet person. A good Christian woman who worships Jesus on her own terms, a good wife, a good mother, a calm listener. And that's about all that we knew about Marjorie Kemp. She was a devout, quiet Christian who had 14 kids and lived in a small village in England called King's Lynn. And then I would like to tell her about this ping pong match that happened in the 1930s, also in England. But I guess first I would have to explain what ping pong is. So it's a game that's usually played by 2 to 4 people, and each person holds a paddle in their hand, and you try to play so that the other person can get to the ball in time. And I guess that's all that she would need to know for now. Anyway, the crazy part about this ping pong match was that one of the players stepped onto the ball
and broke it,
and then went back into his country house to get a new one. And as he was looking through the cupboard to find a ball, he found something else. A book. It looked old, like really, really old, and it was full of notes. He took it to the library to have it checked out by someone professional. And it turns out that this was Marjorie's book, the book that the monk had read and chosen a few parts from to republish. So now there are these two documents, one written by a monk about a quiet, inward-turned Marjorie Kemp, whom he uses as an example of how to be a good, calm Christian woman. And then, newly discovered, there's another one. The original book, Marjorie Kemp's own version, the entire thing, written by herself. Well, actually, she couldn't read or write, so she had to hire scribes, but either way, a book by her own account. In the Middle Ages, there were a few women who had books written about their lives. But normally, the procedure was that someone was a holy woman because they had performed a miracle or two and then gathered a following because of that. And then when they died, someone else would write a book about their life. But Marjorie, she hasn't performed a miracle.
Not that I know of, anyway.
And she also didn't gather a following.
Not in her lifetime.
So I guess at some point, she must have just decided to write a book about herself so that she would be remembered in the way that she wanted. A few medievalists started reading her book, expecting kind of a long-form version of the monk's treatise. But soon they found out that her version of herself was wildly different to what the monk published. She was very Christian, but she wasn't calm, and she definitely wasn't quiet. And she was a mother of 14 kids, but she doesn't really talk about them. Instead, she talks about anything and everything else, and in so much detail. She writes about food and what she likes and doesn't like and how she tries to become a vegetarian at some point, but people are being very difficult about it. She writes about what is arguably the first English account of postpartum depression. Hers was cured by Jesus. About her travels. She traveled to Christian sites of worship all over Europe, sometimes with company, but often alone. She writes about how she decides to wear all white in her 40s. Wearing white was a sign of virginity, and Marjorie had already had 14 kids at that time, so definitely not a virgin. And people in her village did not take this lightly. She writes about her sexual desires, not just towards her husband, but also towards other people and towards Jesus. And she writes about what kind of became her signature move, crying. She cries at every occasion, which gets her excluded from all kinds of social gatherings, and in some cases, even banned from church services. She cries every time she thinks about Jesus, or Mary, or both. When she traveled to Jerusalem, she was so overwhelmed by everything and cried so hard that she fell off her donkey. Overall, she's just this badass who does all of these things that the monk definitely left out on purpose because they don't fit the image that he wanted to create. He totally monkwashed her and took away all of the sexiness and the directness and the dirtiness and the realness of her story.
The person you are trying to reach has been unavailable for over 500 years. Please leave a message after the tone.
Hey Marjorie, this is Sarah calling from the future. I just wanted to leave a quick note and tell you that your book has survived more than 500 years and has made it to the 21st century. It's actually now considered to be the first autobiography in English that is written by a woman, so that's really cool. Congrats. Your book means a lot to me. I think it's really cool and super brave that you decided to write everything down in so much detail. Thank you. Okay, that's it. Thanks and bye.
To me, the Book of Marjorie Kemp is like a little reminder that for a lot of history that we know, we only have the monk version, the edit. Not just because someone chose the parts that they wanted to remember, but because people couldn't write their stories down, or they thought they were too normal, or even too dangerous to be remembered, or because the stories were simply lost. History isn't this thing that we get to document if we only look close enough. It's always just a selection. The Book of Marjorie Kemp honestly fills me with joy. Not because I like her so much or because I find it particularly easy to relate to her or her lifestyle, but because it makes it easier for me to imagine the existence of the other stories. The ones that no one wrote down. The ones that didn't make it to the 21st century.
That was Berlin-based producer Sara Zareh-Hushyori-Ha with her piece called Marjorie, the first in our new weekly segment of short-form audio documentaries.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com. From EBSCO, supporting open source technology and making open platforms possible for libraries of all sizes. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, whose scientists work to lay the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, which are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. DanaFarber.org/everywhere. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve.
Gather round, a new dance has hit the town. Oh man, this is a solid sensation. Watch these cats do this new creation. Boog it, nothing to it, Jack. Boog it, on the mellow track. Boog it, dig it coming back. Bim bam, skim skim, jim jim, wrong. Boog it, everybody now. Boog it, everybody bow. Boog it, take it easy now. Bim bam, skim skim, jim jim, wrong. You do like shining a window, but you ain't got no window, so you just picture a window and boogie, boogie. Slow and easy, then you boogie. Nothing to it, Jack, boogie.